Hello, and welcome to the Dance Physio Podcast, a podcast designed to explore ideas and foster discussion around dancer health and wellness. We're here to challenge the status quo, bridge the gap between dance science and the studio, and help change the landscape of the dance industry for the better. I'm your host, Erica Mayall, a dancer turned physiotherapist who is deeply passionate about leaving the dance world better than I found it. I'm so glad you're here. Let's get started. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Dance Physio Podcast. Today, we are going to be talking all about stress fractures and specifically stress fractures in dancers. So I'm sure most of you have heard the terminology of a stress fracture before, but not everybody knows exactly what that injury actually is, how they present, what we do for treatment and management. So those are all the things we are going to go through today. So in order for us to understand sort of what a stress fracture is, we have to understand a little bit about how bones work. And I think there's a perception often that bones are just these static things. You grow, you finish growing, and your bones are just there for the rest of your life. But in reality, bones are actually one of the most metabolically active tissues in our body. So even though they seem like they're not necessarily changing, and maybe partly because we can't see them under our skin, they are constantly undergoing a process of remodeling. And that process is quite complex when we like break it down at like the physiological level. But in more simplistic terms, that remodeling occurs in response to mechanical loads or mechanical stresses. And so this is why you hear that it's so important to do things like strength training and things like that, especially for prevention of osteoporosis, which is like bone loss that occurs most usually later in life. And it's because that metabolic process that is happening in the body is stimulated through mechanical loading or those mechanical stresses being placed on it. In healthy bones, so in healthy individuals and healthy bones, we have a balance that occurs between how much bone is being sort of remodeled at any given time. So our bones are constantly being like resorbed or like sort of absorbed as the kind of more layman's term for that, but this bone resorption and then bone formation. So in a healthy individual and in normal bone kind of metabolic processes, that process balances itself out. And so we're going to be resorbing certain aspects of the bone and then laying down new bone material or having bone formation that's happening in response to that. And we want that process to be sort of a homeostatic or a stable process. So over time, our bones sort of stay in a steady state. Like I said, if we are intentionally trying to get more bone formation to increase bone density or things like that, then we can actually do that by increasing the mechanical stress on them. So that's where, again, things like resistance training come in, because we can actually get a little bit more of that bone formation happening in response to those mechanical stresses that are happening in the body. On the other side, if that balance is disrupted negatively, we can have injuries that occur. So in the case of a stress fracture, it is essentially a disruption that happens in response to repetitive overloading of that bone. And that repetitive overloading is happening at what we call a submaximal level. So it's not enough that it's going to like break the bone or cause like acute failure in the bone, but it's this repetitive loading that happens over and over and over and over again. And the body can't keep up with the repair process. So again, we have that resorption and then we have that bone formation. And if we are breaking down that bone faster than we can build it back up, we can have these repetitive stress injuries or stress fractures that occur, and eventually those can lead to failure. So I think sometimes there's a perception, especially in the dance world, that a stress fracture is like, you know, an injury that's either there or it's not there. And that's not entirely accurate, because these stress injuries or stress responses occur along a continuum. And so this occurs over a period of time where we have these loads that aren't necessarily balanced. And so this like kind of steady state or homeostasis in the bone gets disrupted. And so this, in the case of dancers, oftentimes is coming from like impact type loading. So that repetitive loading that's happening at those submaximal levels, and that over time starts to disrupt the balance in the bone.
So it happens, like I said, along a continuum of severity. So it's not as if an injury is either present or not present. It slowly, gradually starts to happen. And if we don't address it or if we don't kind of disrupt that process, then it's going to continue to progress along that continuum. And that continuum has three fairly distinct phases. So the first phase that happens is what we call crack initiation. And so that is where we get these little sort of micro cracks or these little like failure sites that are happening. And these occur at the site of stress being placed on the bone. So it depends on the location in the body, whether it's like at the foot or at the leg or the hip or wherever this injury is happening, we're going to have this crack initiation that starts at the site of overloading in that particular bone. If we don't do anything about that and we continue to load the bone in the same way, and so we have this like kind of disequilibrium that is happening, we're going to move into phase two, and that phase is called crack propagation. And so that basically just means that that crack continues to form. So it continues to become more significant if the loading continues to be beyond the capacity for that bone to repair itself. So remember, there's always this metabolic process going on, but if metabolically the bone cannot lay down enough new bone to repair that crack that started, you're going to get that crack propagation or phase two happening in through there. And then phase three would be, again, if we continue to ignore those processes that are happening, continue to like push through, continue to load in the same way, we can actually get complete failure of the bone or a complete fracture. And sometimes this is when stress fractures are actually diagnosed, is when somebody does something, say they land from a jump and all of a sudden they feel like a super sharp pain. They're like, okay, something just happened like in, I don't know, my foot, let's say. And they'll go and get x-rays and they're like, yep, you fractured your foot. And so people are like, oh, okay, well, I fractured my foot when I landed from this jump. But realistically, if you start to dig back in their history, there was likely a stress reaction or a stress response that was already started that they had maybe kind of ignored or had not addressed, had not changed the loading. And then there was one moment in time where the bone completely failed and resulted in a full fracture. So sometimes we see fractures that are happening, but they may be the result of a stress reaction as opposed to a more acute fracture where there was maybe no stress response in the bone and we had an injury, a fall, what have you, and had a fracture that occurred that way. So it's not as common that we see these stress fractures get to phase three and get to that complete fracture, but I've certainly seen it in my practice before for sure. And it is possible if we kind of ignore that phase one and phase two. In an ideal world, well, in an ideal world, we would not be loading to the point of having these stress reactions happening in the body, but realistically, they do happen. So in an ideal world, what we want is to be able to diagnose and intervene in that first phase before it becomes more of a significant issue, because we know that we can actually sort of promote healing and stop that process from continuing along into phase two and phase three if we can catch things early enough in through there. So that's kind of the process of how a stress fracture happens or how this stress reaction happens in the body. So biggest takeaways from that, like I said, are that it happens along a continuum. It's not kind of an all or nothing response, and that it is in response to repetitive loading that the body is not able to recover or repair itself from. And so we get into this cycle where the bone resorption or the stress on the bone becomes faster or more prevalent than our body's ability to lay down new bone and repair that bone in through there. So why do we care about stress fractures in dancers? One of the reasons is because they are quite common. They are one of the more common injuries that we see. In terms of the prevalence, in the general population, prevalence of stress fractures is sort of anywhere between 2 and 15%, depending on what body site you're looking at, what type of the population you're looking at, things like that. In a general sporting population, there's prevalence numbers sort of anywhere up to around 28% in like general sports population. So they're looking at like a combination of sports. And we obviously see higher rates of stress fractures in sports that have more repetitive loading. So distance runners are one of the most common populations that we'll see them in, more so than, you know, a sport that maybe is, I'm just trying to think of an example, something like shot put or something that's more of an explosive sport where like the actual total amount of loading is not so great in those kind of sports. When we look at dancers, and there's not as much literature that's like specifically looked at rates in dancers, but there are some studies. And so in a professional dance population, there's a lifetime incidence of stress fractures around 32%. So what that's telling us with this lifetime incidence is people throughout their dance career, if they go on to have a professional career, 32%, so like one in three dancers basically, will sustain a stress fracture at some point in their career. So that's quite a high number if you think about a company or any sort of professional setting, that one in three dancers will have experienced a stress fracture. So they are certainly common injuries in dance, and we want to try and decrease them as much as we can. And one of the other reasons why they are so problematic in dance and in other sports as well, but they are one of the injuries, or they are the top injury in terms of time loss in pre-professional level dancers. So although they're maybe not the most prevalent injury that happens in a pre-professional level dancer, when we look at the amount of time that dancers need to take away from dance to recover, stress fractures are right up there at the top in terms of how much time dancers are missing. And I don't know that we have the data to support that same claim in a professional dance setting, but I'm sure that it would be similar, one of the top, if not like the top, in terms of time loss injuries. So when we look at it in a professional setting, that's really costly for companies if you have a dancer who's potentially out for long periods of time recovering from these stress fracture injuries. So anything we can do to try and mitigate these and decrease the incidence of them is going to be beneficial for the dancer's health, but also for company finances and things like that as well. With any injury, we look at what risk factors are for injuries, and stress fractures are an injury that have a lot of potential risk factors, some of which are modifiable. And what we mean by that is those are things that we can change and we can like look at improving, and some of them are non-modifiable risk factors. So in the case of stress fractures, a non-modifiable risk factor would be sex. So females have a higher risk of stress fractures than males do. And there's a massive hormonal connection to the metabolic process that happens in bones. I'm not going to get into like the physiology of all of it, but our hormones play a big role in that metabolic process of keeping that homeostasis between resorption and bone formation. And so females just in general are going to be more susceptible to stress fractures partly because of that. And also hormonal imbalances, and specifically females who are dealing with irregular or absent menstrual cycles, are at significantly higher risk of stress fractures. And we'll get into that a little bit more in a second. So that is just an example, that sort of like gender difference is an example of a non-modifiable risk factor in terms of these injuries. An example of a modifiable risk factor for stress fractures is training surfaces. So we know that if we're doing a lot of impact activity, and dance is often very impact intensive, so we're jumping a lot, we're landing a lot, if we're doing those activities on floor surfaces or training surfaces that are really hard, we're dancing on concrete floors, we're dancing on just like very, very hard, non-forgiving surfaces, we're going to have an increased risk of stress fracture versus flooring or training surfaces that have more give to them. And that's one of the reasons why sprung floors are so important in the dance world. And, you know, ideally we want every dancer to be training on sprung floor surfaces just because of the impact that they have. So that would be an example of a modifiable risk factor where we can change our training surfaces. Non-modifiable risk factors are things that are just inherent that we can't actually change, but we need to be aware of them, because then we maybe need to look at some of the modifiable risk factors more closely. Other risk factors for stress fractures, nutrition is a huge one. From both a sort of total caloric sufficiency perspective, so we know that dancers who suffer from what's called RED-S, or relative energy deficiency in sport, so that is an insufficient caloric intake to meet the demands of the energy that they're expending while they're dancing, those dancers are going to be at increased risk of stress fractures. And this plays in, again, it's like a fairly complicated metabolic process. And I will at some point actually do an entire podcast episode on RED-S because it's such an important topic, but it disrupts the hormone balance as well, and can disrupt menstrual cycles and things like that. And so it has a really big role to play in that homeostatic process that happens with the bone metabolism in through there. There's other things that have to do with nutritional status as well. So things like calcium and vitamin D, certain vitamins and minerals are really important in our bone metabolic processes as well. So if we have an imbalance in any of those important vitamins and minerals, we can be at increased risk for stress fractures. Low bone mineral density leads to increased risk of stress fractures, and this could be for various reasons. So there are some people that suffer from low bone mineral density as side effects of medications that they have to be on and things like that, potentially genetic reasons. And then there are also people who are going to suffer from low bone mineral density as a result of some of these kind of nutritional deficiencies that we were talking about earlier in RED-S. That is one of the effects of that relative energy insufficiency, is that we can actually lead to lower bone mineral density. So that's something we want to look at if we have dancers who we're concerned about with regards to risk for stress fractures. Abnormal bony alignment, or just alignment in general, anatomical alignment can have a significant impact on risk factors or on risk for stress fractures. And one example of this, just so you sort of know what I'm talking about, if we think about the structure of somebody's foot, for as an example, we have, you know, some people that are going to have a more mobile foot. We're going to have some people that are going to have a more rigid foot. Some people's feet are going to go more into that pronation position. Some people's feet are more into that supination position. And people who tend to have a more rigid, supinated foot are going to be at increased risk for a stress fracture versus somebody who has a little bit of a more mobile foot, or a foot that can go into a little bit of more pronated position, because that sort of mobility and ability to go into those positions and to like kind of move a bit more helps with shock absorption. And if we don't have that due to our bony structure, there's going to be more force transmitted throughout the rest of the body. So that's just an example, again, of sort of things that maybe aren't completely modifiable, but if we are aware of the structure, say, of this dancer's foot, that they have a higher arched, more rigid, more supinated foot, we may look at other things that we want to try and do to help mitigate the amount of impact that's being placed on that dancer's body, or things like that, to really try and decrease the risk of stress fractures, and looking at some of those other modifiable risk factors. So things like bony alignment, just anatomical alignment, and also biomechanics. So sometimes it is not the, you know, fixed structure of somebody's body that can put them at risk, but just how they're moving or how they are loading their body. So we always want to look at, okay, biomechanically, is there something that is putting this dancer at risk for a stress fracture in a particular area of the body? Other things that can be risk factors: changes in training volume or training intensity, and especially sudden changes. So when we have these sudden spikes in training loads, training intensities, we know that we are increasing our risk for these overuse or these repetitive sort of strain injuries to be happening. And that's simply because this metabolic process that happens with the bones reforming, or that bone formation, it takes time for our body to like adjust to these changes in loads. So if we're slowly, gradually increasing our training load, we can likely, up to a certain point at least, accommodate for that. And our body can adjust that balance between resorption and bone formation and account for that and adapt to it. And again, that's like the principles behind like weight training and strength training are that we increase it slowly and gradually enough that we actually get these positive bone formation effects in the long term. But if we do that too suddenly, so we all of a sudden spike our training load, our body doesn't have a chance to catch up to that, and we just end up in this like kind of deficiency state where the resorption or the stress on the bone is happening faster than our body's ability to repair or lay down new bone in that area. So that's why it's not just the overall training loads, but it's the sudden changes in them as well that's problematic. And we've talked about that a little bit on like the podcast episode about training loads, not specifically in regards to bone injury necessarily, but just injury in general with those kind of spikes or sudden changes in training loads. Overall, training load also has a role to play in risk factor for stress fractures. So we know from research that dancers who are training more than 5 hours a day increases their risk 16 times over dancers who train less than 5 hours a day. I will say that again because it's rather mind-blowing. So dancers who are training more than 5 hours a day are 16 times more likely to get a stress fracture than dancers who are training less than 5 hours a day. And again, in the training load episode of the podcast, and I'll link that in the show notes if anybody hasn't listened to it and you want to go back and listen to it, this is one of the reasons why we make the recommendations that we do about training loads for dancers is because of some of these risk factors that we know exist. And in this case, specifically stress fracture risk factors being so much higher with over 5 hours of training in a day. So that is by no means an exhaustive list of all of the risk factors. There are others, and if you're interested, you can certainly like Google and look at what some of the other risk factors are. But those are some of the more common ones that we see that pertain to like a dance population in terms of both the modifiable and non-modifiable risk factors for dancers. In terms of a diagnosis, how do we know if a dancer has sustained a stress fracture or is dealing with sort of a stress reaction? Sometimes these can be tricky to diagnose because especially if we want to catch them in the early phases, which we do so that we can kind of like put a stop to that sort of continuum so we don't progress from phase one to phase two to phase three, if we are trying to catch them early, they can sometimes be tricky because pain may or may not be present, and we'll talk about that more in a second. And sometimes their symptoms are a little bit kind of vague or not very specific, where they'll sort of report, you know, maybe achy feelings or, you know, kind of pain that comes and goes, and it bothers them sometimes, but then it'll be fine for a few days, and then it bothers them again later. And so it's not always like really, really specific when you're like getting a history from a dancer in terms of what might be going on sort of underlying. One interesting thing that was found in a study, I want to say out of Australia, but I could be wrong about that. They noted that especially for stress fractures in feet, one of the first symptoms that people were reporting was like not pain or anything like that, but dancers were reporting a lot of cramping in their feet as a precursor to them being diagnosed with a stress fracture. So things like that, so symptoms that, you know, are present and are like kind of consistently there, but are not necessarily like a pain or a specific pain, could be an indication that there is something going on. And so in this case in particular, it was like cramping of the feet that was like the first indication that maybe we need to like evaluate this dancer for a stress fracture. There are some clinical tests that we can do from like assessment perspective. They're not particularly like sensitive in terms of their accuracy of diagnosis, but there's some sort of, I don't want to say old wives' tales because it actually is still like really commonly used, but bones respond to vibration. So one of the things that we sometimes use is like a tuning fork. If people have played an instrument, you might be familiar with those. And if you whack the tuning fork and then put it on the bone, that vibration can sometimes be irritating to people with a stress reaction going on in a bone in through there. But again, some of these things that we maybe will utilize clinically are not necessarily super accurate or super sensitive. So really, to properly properly diagnose a stress fracture, we actually often do need imaging. So a lot of injuries, we don't actually need to go to imaging to be able to manage these. But stress fractures are ones that imaging is actually often quite important, because otherwise we may not figure out what's going on. They're also a little bit tricky because a stress fracture, at least in those early phases in phase one and phase two, will not usually show up on a plain x-ray because it's not a complete fracture through the bone, because it's more of a metabolic process. It will often not show up. And that's usually one of the first things that is ordered in terms of imaging. And sometimes that's because it has to be ordered before they're allowed to order anything else. And there's various reasons for it. But oftentimes people will get an x-ray done and they'll come back and they'll say, oh, I had an x-ray and it didn't show anything, so I'm fine, I can keep dancing. And in reality, x-rays, the vast majority of the time, unless we're looking at a more long-term or significant injury where it's kind of progressed to a more frank fracture in through there, it is not going to show up on a plain x-ray. So just because a plain x-ray is negative does not mean there is not a stress fracture present. So we actually need to be utilizing either an MRI or a bone scan to be able to diagnose a stress fracture. And MRI is considered sort of like the gold standard for stress fracture diagnosis. And that's partly just because of its sensitivity and specificity. And it also has the ability to look at soft tissues and other things at the same time. So if we have access to MRI, then that really is the gold standard. However, depending on where you are in the world, and certainly here in BC in Canada, we often have really long wait lists for MRIs, and it may not be the first thing that is ordered if we're suspecting a stress fracture injury. So more often than not, we're actually utilizing bone scans. And bone scans are super, super useful and very good at detecting and picking up a stress fracture, because they're actually measuring the metabolic activity in a bone. And like we talked about, these stress reactions, especially in the early phases, are a metabolic process. And so they can detect stress fractures really well. However, bone scans are not very useful for monitoring an injury, because they can stay metabolically active or show these hot spots on a scan up to a year after the injury has occurred. And that's just because that repair process, that metabolic process, continues on for a long period of time. Even after the original kind of stress reaction is healed, people are back to doing activity, it will continue to show as a hot spot. So if we want to be sort of monitoring and being like, okay, this person had a stress fracture, is it healing appropriately? Is it healing how we want it to be? We can't use a bone scan to monitor healing, but we can use them for initial diagnosis. With that being said, if somebody had had a stress fracture 6 months previously and then they're having a bone scan, it still could show the result from that. So you might get a positive result that's maybe not super accurate to that moment in time, if that makes sense, but they certainly are a good alternative for initial diagnosis. They just are not useful for monitoring progress. And so then really an MRI is the best tool available to us from an imaging perspective in order to be able to monitor progress. We often don't need imaging to monitor progress. And we'll talk about that in a second, because we're going to talk about management and treatment. But when we're looking at how people are healing and progressing, we are often not re-imaging them. We're kind of using more symptom tolerance and like loading tolerance as an indication of like readiness for returning to activity and dance and things like that. So just in terms of diagnosis of stress fractures, like I said, the history can be a little, or their symptoms can be a little bit tricky sometimes, and sometimes they don't present super, super obviously. But if we're looking at imaging, then an MRI is gold standard, but bone scans are also useful. A plain x-ray will not give us the information we need about a bone scan, or sorry, a stress fracture. So moving on to sort of management or treatment of stress fractures, what do we do about them? And this is a question I get asked a lot, because, and especially from dance teachers, where they'll say, you know, I have this dancer and they were diagnosed with a stress fracture and they're going to be out for, you know, X amount of time. But this other dancer who had a stress fracture was only out for this amount of time. So why is, you know, say one is like 3 months and the other one was only 6 weeks or something like that. So why is like the management so different with, like, from dancer to dancer. And so teachers sometimes questioning, like, is it truly going to take them that long to recover, or things like that. And the reason for that is that when we look at management for stress fractures, there's two different things that we take into consideration for kind of how these stress fractures are managed. So one of them is called risk, and the other one is the grade of the stress fracture. So the risk is kind of classified as either high risk or low risk. And risk is based on anatomical location of the fracture. So there are certain areas that we can get stress fractures in the body that are considered lower risk than others. So they are not as likely to have problems with healing. They're lower load-bearing bones or things like that. So an example of that in a dancer, well, in anybody, but ones we might see in dancers, the fibula. So that is the bone on your lower leg, but the outside bone. So not your main lower leg bone, but the one that runs down the outside. And it is not a super significant weight-bearing bone. The fibula is a really important bone in terms of the mechanics of how the knee works and the ankle works and things like that. But when we are actually weight-bearing or loading through our legs, most of the load is actually going through our tibia, the other lower leg bone. So there's not as much load going through the fibula. So for that reason, it is considered lower risk in terms of stress fracture, like when we're classifying things as high risk or low risk. Another example would be like the base of the second metatarsal. It's a really common area for a stress fracture, but just because of the anatomy of it and how it's kind of secured by other bones in the midfoot of the in your midfoot, it is again considered more low risk when we're thinking about like healing processes. On the other end of that, we have bones that are considered more high risk bones. So the tibia in the lower leg, it's our primary weight bearing bone of the lower extremity, or like of our lower leg. And so it's going to be more high risk. Or the base of the fifth metatarsal, as opposed to the second metatarsal, because it's on the outside of your foot, it has more mobility, it has more stress that goes through it, it is considered higher risk in through there. In dancers, another bone that's considered high risk that we see stress fractures in that is very uncommon in other populations, but we do see them in dancers a lot, is the sesamoid bones. So those are the little tiny bones underneath your big toe. They're these like little floating bones. They look like two little peas almost. And it's uncommon to see stress fractures in those sesamoid bones in the general population or even other sporting populations. But because of the amount of time that dancers spend on demi-point or with their big toe like fully extended, we actually do see stress fractures in these bones, and they would be considered sort of a high-risk location. So things that are higher risk are going to be treated more conservatively versus things that are lower risk in terms of managing a stress fracture. So we look at risk based on anatomical location. And then we also look at the grade of the injury. And so stress fractures are graded from grade 1 to grade 5. And you don't need to necessarily like know all of this, but a grade 1 would actually be a stress fracture that isn't presenting with any pain. So these are not super commonly diagnosed. And I would say if we do find these, it's often like incidental findings. Like they'll be imaging for something completely unrelated and they'll be like, oh, we also saw on imaging that there was evidence of stress reaction in the bone, but there's no fracture line present. So there's a stress reaction or something going on in the bone, but no frank fracture has been detected. A grade 2 is similar, but there would also be the presence of pain. So on imaging, we see that there is evidence of a stress reaction. There's no frank fracture line, but the person's also experiencing pain or symptoms of that. Grade 3 would be a non-displaced fracture line. So this is when those like stress reactions have continued on and now there is an obvious fracture line in the bone. So not just like kind of a hot spot or an area of stress reaction, but like an actual fracture. So that would be a grade 3. Grade 4 is a displaced fracture. So that might be somebody who had a grade 3 and then they went and did something like they landed from a jump or something and they actually displaced that fracture. And then a grade 5 is like a non-union. So this would be somebody who had that frank fracture and it just isn't healing appropriately. And so it's what they consider to be like non-union. I honestly, in my practice, have not seen a grade 5 as a result of a stress fracture. I've seen non-union fractures for other reasons, but not as a result of a stress fracture. And I would say the vast majority of stress fractures that we see clinically are in that grade 2 or grade 3 sort of category, where they're kind of in the middle of that grading scheme. And so again, our options for management are going to be dependent on the risk area and then also the grade of the fracture. So treatment can range from, you know, if it's a low risk area, so say we have the, let's say, base of the second metatarsal and it's a low grade, so it's like a grade 1 or grade 2, our treatment might be fairly minimal, in the sense that, you know, maybe they don't need to be in a walking boot. Maybe their treatment at that point is just that we are minimizing or eliminating the amount of impact they're doing. So we want them in, you know, maybe a rigid shoe, so they're getting like good support from like footwear. They're going to be wearing a shoe the majority of the time, so even having like an indoor shoe option or things like that, but they can still walk around on the foot. We just don't want them jumping, running, doing things that are higher impact. That might be the way of managing a kind of low risk, low grade stress fracture. On the opposite end of things, if we have a high risk area and a higher grade, so we're looking at like a grade 3, grade 4, grade 5, the treatment might be much more significant. So it could range from like completely non-weight bearing. We might have somebody who's like actually using crutches and not allowed to put any weight in that area for 6 weeks. We might have somebody who's wearing a boot. In extreme cases of like the non-union, they will often go in and actually like surgically stabilize the area. So there's massive variation and variability about how stress fractures are managed. And it's because we're not just looking at the location of the stress fracture, we're also looking at the grade. And so you have to kind of pair those two things together. And that's going to determine how limited somebody is in their sort of function or how much they're allowed to do while they are recovering from this stress fracture. So when we look at kind of returning to dance or returning to activity, or what can dancers participate in when they are dealing with a stress fracture, it is going to vary, again, depending on their risk and their grade of their stress fracture. So we may have dancers who can participate to some degree in class with some modifications to limit or eliminate impact. So an example of that would be, again, if we have a low risk, low grade stress fracture, we might allow a dancer to come into class and they may need to be wearing like solid footwear. So we'll have them in like a pair of running shoes or something like that that's giving their foot support. And they can participate in all aspects of class that don't involve any impact. So they wouldn't be doing any jumping or running or things like that, but they'd be able to participate in doing, you know, elements of class that don't incorporate those types of things. On the other side, if we have high risk, high grade stress fracture, they may be like completely, you know, non-weight bearing or out of the studio or away for, you know, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, depending on the nature of the injury. So it really is going to be quite variable, but we generally will progress from low or no impact. And then we're going to slowly progress people. And as they're recovering and as we're monitoring the healing process, we're going to then progress them to low impact or like body weight type activities and exercises. And then we can progress them into dance specific training stuff and still probably monitoring and limiting their impact load through these phases. And then eventually the final phase of being able to return to dance is returning to like unrestricted training and performance or competition or whatever. And so that would be doing full impact jumping, things like that. One of the reasons stress fractures can be a long process to recover and return from is because we have to be very gradual about the way we increase their impact and loading. So even if we have a dancer who's like, okay, I have a stress fracture. I took 6 weeks off dance. I didn't do anything. I like sat around, stayed off my foot, whatever. I'm just assuming it's a foot stress fracture, but it could be anything. And then they're like, okay, I did my 6 weeks, I'm just going to return to dance. And they return straight back into the same level of loading that they were doing previously. Chances are that's not going to go well. They're either going to have a recurrence of the same injury or potentially develop stress reactions somewhere else. But often it's a recurrence of the same injury. Because after that 6 weeks, although they may be pain-free now, they may feel a lot better, it is likely not 100% healed. Like we talked about, that metabolic process of like repair is ongoing and it takes longer than that. And it needs that gradual increase in loading to be able to respond to that. So we cannot just assume that taking time away from dance and like unloading the area is going to be enough to heal and repair the area. We also really have to take into consideration the gradual return. And sometimes that's the longer part of the recovery from a stress fracture, is how do we slowly, gradually return back to dance and increase their loading in a gradual enough way that their body can adapt and repair and recover from that, so that we don't sort of exacerbate the injury or, stall that healing process. So that's actually probably like one of the reasons why healing or returning to dance after a stress fracture is one of the longer time loss injuries in dance, because the return to impact loading needs to be quite slow and gradual. So I realize we are approaching the 40-minute mark, or maybe we're at the 40-minute mark, which is fairly long for this podcast. So I'm going to wrap things up there. I know that was a lot of information about stress fractures. I hope that was helpful to all of you out there. I know it's one of the things that we get a lot of questions about, and especially the management of them, because there is a lot of variability in how they're managed. And so that leaves not just dancers, but also teachers and other people kind of a bit confused about the management of them. But I hope you have a better understanding of why they are managed the way that they are managed, and also the process that is like involved and is happening with stress fractures. If you have any questions, comments, want more information about this, please feel free to reach out to me. You can reach me on social media at Dance Physio Erica with a K, or you can email me, and my email is in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.